You're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource, and we are grateful to all of our listeners who help us keep the podcast going by donating to the show, which is something that everyone can do by going to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. A special thank you also goes out to the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their substantive support of the show. Welcome to episode 66, where we are discussing workplace isolation, or rather isolation in the workplace. And specifically focusing on the paper by Tom Forrester from 1988, The Myth of the Electronic Cottage. My name is Dmitrijs, coming to you from Kuldīga in Latvia.
Here's Greta, calling in from Oxford.
Here's Leonardo, calling in from São Paulo, Brazil.
And here's Ella, calling from Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
So Ella's back.
Yeah, I'm back. It's very good to be back.
Yay!
It's great to have you back. And yes, Ella today is our special guest, who will enlighten us and fact-check all of our knowledge and information on remote working. So it's a pleasure. Would you like to do the honors of introducing the text?
Sure, yes. So I'm enjoying this reunion and a really interesting topic around remote work. And so this paper that we're discussing today is called The Myth of the Electronic Cottage by Tom Forrester. And in true Talking About Organizations style, this is a classic paper. It's quite an old one from 1988. And it's actually a response to another paper, which is by Alvin Toffler, which was from 1980, who had this idea of the electronic cottage. So there were a lot of futurists, futurologists, they had various names at the time, who were saying, with all this computing technology that's coming, the whole world's going to change, work will not be as we know it, and why don't we take all this work that we're doing in these expensive office buildings into the home? So that whole notion of home working, and also this article is broader than that, it also covers home commerce. This is going to be the future. And so that was the contention from Toffler, but here Forrester's coming back and saying, do you know what? This is a myth. The electronic cottage is not going to happen for various reasons. And he outlines the problems that he foresees with these lofty predictions that have been made. And some of those are technical, and that's quite amusing now looking back, and I'm sure we'll get to it, saying that this is never going to fly, we'll never get home offices set up, this technology is too difficult and too expensive and too cumbersome, so that's not going to happen. But then he also goes into psychological reasons for why people will not want to work in the home, issues around loneliness and isolation and the need for connection. And this today is actually a theme that's still resonating, and especially now that everyone's working from home during times of coronavirus, it's a theme worth revisiting. So the paper really shows some real insights that stick today and others that have proven to be a little short-sighted at least. So I'm looking forward to discussing this with you all.
Right. So there's three main focuses in this paper. The idea that, the general technological determinism that the paper is arguing against, and Forrester is focusing on two things, right? So the working at home part, the IT-based services part, which is very entertaining, and the home informatics part. So the working at home part of the paper is, I found this to be more interesting, even though in the actual paper it's mainly introducing statistics and numbers for how many people telecommute, essentially work from home, or commute to work by means of digital technology. And while Forrester does indicate that there are trends that he suggests are marginal, but there's still trends towards the direction that people do end up working from home more with time. Then the other part, the IT-based services part, that has to do more with technology and specifically on how people are not picking up things like online banking as quickly as certain theorists and advocates at the time anticipated. as well as that online shopping is not really picking up anywhere. So clearly that didn't age super well, given Amazon and generally the amount of online shopping done. And then finally, the final issue here is the home informatics, which is to do with the actual infrastructure and technology that is available for people to work from home. And here Forrester seems to be somewhat more optimistic with respect to what is already available. Mind you, in 1988, and while we're on that, well, I didn't particularly appreciate you calling this paper old because it's the same age as I am, which is, I think, young and full of vitality.
Of course, of course. I mean, in the context of technology.
So there it is, the three arguments. The technology available to people to work at, to use as infrastructure. The general trends of the population with respect to online services, such as banking and shopping. And of course, the kind of broader societal trends of how people are picking up. Back in 1988, seems to be sort of okay for the trends, definitely a no-no for online services, and somewhat promising for the infrastructure, at least in so far as I've read it.
Yeah, I agree. And I also like the work from home part the most. It's drawing heavily on a study done by Atkinson around that time, and also drawing on some personal experiences and a little study that Forrester did with some of his friends in Brighton, if I remember well. A group of five friends who all first always commuted to London and then decided to work from home over a period of time and kind of discussing and monitoring their experiences around that.
That was really depressing, though. It's like these five friends, two of them got divorced, one went mad or something, and then the other one went back to work in London.
It's not exactly
not,
yeah.
Not a good ad for remote work at all.
And I think even for the one that they thought it was a success, it was still a little bit dubious if what was happening exactly at the home front and if the wife agreed as well.
You know what really shocked me straight out the gates with this paper? Is that this is a work written 32 years ago, right? But literally, the first sentence is that for 20 years or more, futurists have posited growth in cottage industry as part of a wider argument that computers and information technology play a decentralizing role in society. And that, like, seriously, people in the 60s were talking about that? That shocked me.
Why?
What?
Why did it shock you?
Well, because when you think of 60s, you don't think of remote work, right? Remote work, you think of the internet. At least I do. Maybe I should stop putting that on you, but I think of remote work as something that wouldn't really come about until like the 2000s or something like that. But no, it has, and it has been thought of and possible to an extent for a while with, you know, faxes and telephones and all that kind of antique stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, this, I think, is where it's so nice to look at the history of remote work, because it's actually an old idea. It used to be normal to work from home. So that whole cleavage of we actually have to have a separation between home and work was really introduced with the Industrial Revolution, and then with the work, the shift to clerical work, where you had instrumentation or devices that needed to be stored locally. So actually technology had a centralizing force to begin with because it was expensive and heavy, and so it had to sit in offices, and that's where you had to go for work. But prior to that, actually, it was much more common to work in the home, and the office was that was actually a position that you held rather than a place that you went to, you had the office of, etc. And I like to think about, too, some really old examples, like the Oxford English Dictionary. The story of it is told in the film, it's also a book, The Professor and the Madman. And they crowdsourced the entire Oxford English Dictionary by getting people to send in quotations with words in them from all over the world. And that was a very long time ago. So this idea that work is distributed is actually a pre-modern era idea that then got disrupted through the early 20th century. So that's why it doesn't surprise me so much that they were starting to think, oh, we could just go back to the home.
Yeah, well, we had an episode recently on the Hudson's Bay Company where it was pretty obvious that the idea of decentralized or distributed, rather, organizations is not new at all. But here we're looking at it from almost an employee perspective rather than from an organizational or strategic or design perspective. And then the idea of working from home takes on a very different hue than if we're thinking of structuring businesses and coordinating them. Because the means of production then move back into the house. So they talk about the cottage industry coming back, like the electronic cottage is back. And so I went to read, as I would, about history of that. And there are points to discuss in part two of the episode. But yeah, fundamentally, this idea that there would be some sort of a distribution agent, actor, that would then assign work to people who would then do it from home by means of their electronic infrastructure. I mean, it's not that far-fetched, right?
And how I read the paper is basically a big criticism against technological determinism. You know, like, even though, you know, this paper is written in the 80s, the journal is also nice to mention. It's called Futures, so it's a bit, you know, predicting the future. But I think Forrester is spot on saying that, you know, just because the technologies are there to work from home or to shop online, it doesn't mean that necessarily that that's going to happen. And if you look at work, people should want to work from home. And then his point is, well, actually, the people that do explore it actually say, like, but not for me. There are very few people that have the personalities or, find it rewarding to work from home. And he's actually pointing out a lot of the psychological problems that workers have. And that's what I like so much about the paper. And I'd love to dive into it a little bit more deeply with you guys.
Yeah, I really like that part where he is effectively arguing that just because it's shiny and new, I guess not that new, shiny and 20 years old, it doesn't mean that that's how it's going to be. And the passage where the part of the paper on working at home brings up a lot of very good points that have to do with that it's not just whether you have the ability to do that, it's also whether it's possible. And he has this interesting point here that on page 230, that working at home is largely a middle-class issue, since most of the occupations that can be done at home are middle-class, and that most computer owners are well-off, well-educated, and white. And while that's not necessarily the case anymore, it's not that it's not a case at all anymore.
I think it was interesting that, of course, the paper is against this technological determinism, but it is against some kind of technological optimism too. Because if you take this, especially Alvin Toffler, that he quotes a lot, we see a lot of optimists thinking about how the technology, especially information, communication technology, will bring some kind of freedom to everybody. And especially we have a lot of literature on the 80s about this kind of optimism, especially in the kinds of new organizational structures, especially coming from new computer industries coming on the market and disrupting. And
yeah, and not to forget that, you know, when we're talking about technology, I mean, organizations are a technology. And if you look at it from that unit of analysis, then technology as, you know, computers and telephones, that's more of an instrument. And it seems that back then, as is now, the idea that technology as, you know, as instruments are an end in their own right has been very much out and about, and it's been very popular, this technological optimism that was going back then at the advent of the IBM PC era. But what I really, really enjoyed about Forrester is that he doesn't seem to buy that. Like, he's aware that there's more to work and there's more to organizations, even though he's not explicit about organizations here, than just the tools that people use in order to get the work done. And he does mention a few things like the social environments that are provided, as well as the kind of personal aspects of working from home that are not conducive to work, like children crying or not crying, and spouses being present, you know, at work. You wouldn't go to an office and have your spouse right there in your cubicle. And he's very aware and critical of others who do not appreciate these very fundamental aspects of being a human worker that give way to technology. And in fact, what Ella mentioned earlier about the Industrial Revolution centralizing work, so taking away the cottages from the cottage industry and putting them into factories, I think that's a pretty important point there, because once the means of production were no longer attainable to individual workers, it's only then that large factories began to emerge. And we know that from episode one of this podcast, the scientific management of F.W. Taylor. You know, it wasn't about getting people in there so you can control and oversee them in 16-hour shifts. It was more that, you know, a steam engine was a really expensive piece of technology that was huge and had to be attached to a giant factory in order to drive the whole thing. And, with electronic means of production being more accessible, I mean, maybe there is something to it, but it's not to forget that it's not just the technology that is at play here.
I think that's a really good point. But I also like, Dimitris, what you were mentioning earlier around the issue of class and who has access to this type of work. I think it's a really important point. And it goes a little bit hand in hand with a critique that he makes later on, which is that not all homes are set up for remote work spatially either. I'm sure we'll come to other factors, as you've already mentioned, that can make the home not conducive to work. But this is also what I find so interesting about remote work as well. It's sort of the domestic hitting the kind of professional and what that interface looks like. And as work did shift more into factories and then also more into cities, and people had to live close to these centralized locations, homes also became smaller. It was not a farmstead anymore. We had a lot more density, apartments. And in my own research on remote work, I was studying people in Australia who tended to have quite a bit of space, but I always wondered what would it look like to be a remote worker in somewhere like Tokyo or Hong Kong, where the apartments are very small. And that having the idea that you could create all of these different zones within your home for work and for rest and for family time, it's not feasible or practical. So I like that there is a sensitivity here to investigating people's different circumstances as well. It can often be treated in a very monolithic way, like everyone can work remotely now that we have this technology. But there are all of these differences and nuances, including around space, that need to be considered.
I couldn't agree more. And this is also what Forrester mentions at some part in his article, that the advantages and disadvantages of working at home are seldom explored in any real depth or in any relation to empirical evidence. And the literature seriously underestimates the psychological problems of working at home. And that's why I'm just so happy to have you on board as a guest in this episode, Ella, because you've been doing fantastic work in this area. And, me and my team at Oxford have also looked extensively, looking at remote work happening on these online freelancing marketplaces. And, when I read the text, and especially when Forrester dives a bit into the evidence that he managed to collect in the 80s, I'm like, this is still true today. This is very valid. He was spot on there. That was just a big, we can learn a lot, the things that he points out in his paper is what we experience all at this moment. And it was not a choice for us to all work from home. It wasn't technology that moved us home. No, it was an epidemic. And so that's where you see, there are many, many factors that you know, these futurists or technology experts just completely overlook in predicting the future.
Absolutely. And then there's that issue of it taking some time to get good at this endeavor of remote working. And Forrester mentions it briefly, but it actually is a skill that develops over time. And especially in the current context, that's not something that's allowed us. You know, we have to immediately start to work remotely as if we're experts in it. And I think that with the technologically led shift to remote work as well as an idea, then you also get this sense that, well, the technology makes it possible, therefore overnight you should be working from home. It's easy, simple, and it doesn't acknowledge just how many practices we've built up over such a long period of time that are office-bound or that are based on co-located interaction. And it will take some time to translate that into a different context and with digital technologies as well.
I really like when he said that anyone who's advocating work from home has likely never worked from home at one point. And or rather, not anyone, but those who he is criticizing, that overlooking all of these factors to do with the psychological effects as well as personal circumstances is just disingenuous if you're going to advocate working from home.
It was just very funny reading that. I think it's still true today. Well, we do have some experience now, but probably the ones that write about it are middle class people having a computer and probably an office space to work in their home rather than being in a small flat with little children and just juggling around. Yeah, in the study of Atkinson, yeah, I keep bugging about it because that's like where some of the empirics come from in Forrester paper. Like it mentions like some of the psychological difficulties of working at home and a lack of motivation and discipline, inability to organize work and manage your time effectively, feelings of loneliness, family tensions arising. Also, things like fear of failure, burnout, stress, hypochondria, those are some of the things that were pointed out in the study that Atkinson did about people in the 80s working from home. And I think we all recognize it now, we experience it, and it makes us think like, okay, what does the office then mean to us if it's... Is it just a place to work, or is it more?
Yeah. Besides that, I think some point that he puts is very interesting, that you can that's something that astonishes here, especially in Brazil today, because many people move to work through offices to work from home. It's the proper access to internet. That is something that is not available to all. And it's interesting because he says in the text that it's necessary to have a proper infrastructure, especially fiber optic. Because there's something that is, until now, is something very important to discuss because you have better connections with fiber optics. You can, we have loss of package. It's the better connection, the better technology for connecting through the internet. And in the 80s, he's discussing that is some kind of issue that we still have got to resolve here in many countries, not only here, but...
In Australia, too. They've really messed up the national broadband network. They were planning on fiber optic to the home, but it has not happened. And they've saved money on it because they thought, well, it's only video gamers that need fast internet. Turns out, no, it's actually quite important for the economy to be able to work from home. But when I was doing research with remote workers, I remember a guy saying, you know, my internet drops out when it rains. And this is in Australia, which is a pretty wealthy country, and you'd think that that would be something that would be pretty stable. But even then, working in a high-tech industry, working from home is still fraught with these challenges. And so even though our devices are incredibly powerful now, this fundamental infrastructure that underlies it still hasn't received the investment that, as you say, was being asked for even back then.
Yeah, it's the opposite here. We have in Latvia. We have excellent, one of the best internet connections in Europe, but not that many businesses are still operating on the technology that would, you know, need that. There is very limited use of cloud computing. There is so it's sort of the opposite of what you said, that yeah, the connection is great, but the people who are mainly using it, you know, well, they're not gamers, but sort of for more recreational means still. So, you know, again, just having the technology or not having it is not the only driver or even the main driver for why something will or will not be adapted with respect to work.
Yes, and there is also on another point that he made in this part, that you we cannot see not the advantage, but the return of technology on the economy. And he quotes Friedman here, talking about how the time lag that was necessary to electricity to have some impact on the economy at all. And this is interesting because in terms of IT, it's something that we discuss until now by this kind of productivity paradox of ICT ICT things, because of the productivity paradox that Robert Solow put in the 80s, that computer age are everywhere, but in the productivity statistics. So it's something that he's discussing, that we cannot see yet how technology is improving the economy, is improving the living of the workers, and how this could be useful for the economy as for the overall economy. And this is a concern that is still around.
Well, I mean, yeah, it just shows that work is very interdependent and interconnected and nested and all of those things that we study. Because if we again take the industrial revolution of the early 1900s as a case in point, right, why scientific management came about, it wasn't that, you know, factories appeared and then Frederick Winslow Taylor and friends appeared as well, right? It came about because factories were ineffective, because there wasn't standardization of work. Machinists were doing their own thing and breaking stuff in the process, and there were these gangs of workers who wouldn't, you know, cooperate with management and give them false information for benchmarking and, you know, well, the precursor to benchmarking anyway. So scientific management came about to study what work is, to measure it, and then to figure out what are the ways to do it. But that hasn't been the case with the digital technology, right? We're sort of just left with these things, the laptops, the phones and the fax machines and, you know, the internet, and then we're supposed to kind of transition our work into the digital way of doing work ourselves. There isn't a time motion studies person standing behind us trying to figure out what's, you know, what's the one best way, or what are at least some of the better ways to do things. And yeah, I mean, I'm not saying there should be, but that's a fundamental difference between when we transitioned to industrialized work in the factories and when we're now failing to transition to these digital electronic cottages.
Yeah, so this is interesting though, because he does talk about self-management, and that the problem is, and this was from Atkinson's study, that people are not good enough self-managers, and that is why remote work fails, because we can't keep ourselves to account, basically. And I mean, this probably relates to themes that we'll discuss in the second section as well. But I think that has actually all become caught up in attempts to manage working from home in exactly the way that Taylor would have loved. And these digital tools that are used now for working from home have also become really useful tools for people who do want to count and measure things like keystrokes, which is unfortunately a whole industry that's popping up again right now, a lot of interest in how can we monitor remote workers who are working from home. So even though the type of work we're doing and the environment that we're doing in it has changed, there still seems to be a resurgence of this more Tayloristic approach.
Right, but that seems more to do with observation and, you know, control of some sort. You know, the thing that Zoom had in the early days where it would tell you if someone clicked away or not, you know, that's not a mechanism to improve someone's work. That's a mechanism to figure out if they're doing what you think they're supposed to be doing. And that's a large difference. Like, yes, Taylorism, well, I can't speak for Taylorism, but scientific management, as we've read from the original texts, which you should all go back and listen to in episode one or listen to the audiobook, it wasn't about controlling what, you know, the Schmidt guy from the book was up to. It was about figuring out how to make it better. It was the largest organized training program, I think, in the history of the world thus far. That's not to do with the military anyway. But that's not the case now. Again, it's sort of more, seems to be more to do with checking whether people are doing what they're meant to be doing and less to do with figuring out how to improve their proficiency of the tools that they're working with.
I think there are kind of two parts on this in this conversation. When you think about management and control, when you move from work in an office to working from home. And one is when you think about the division of labor, who manages, and what you saw, you know, prior to the Industrial Revolution, going into the Industrial Revolution, you see a division of labor and suddenly you have a manager that checks input measures of productivity. It measures if you're actually working. So instead of output, it went to input. So that's the other part. Like, what do you measure to measure productivity? And now when we work from home, we have to self-manage again. And what Forrester says, and Atkinson also said, was, you know, a lot of people are not very good at it. People fail very much. And not in the way you think. They overwork. They think they don't work enough, they exhaust themselves, and at the detriment of their family lives. So that's the biggest risk of working. And then, you know, when you think, okay, what is then the role of the manager when you cannot see your employees? How do you check they actually do their work? Well, what Atkinson says in his other paper written in the 80s, Homework, is you should use output measures for remote workers rather than input measures. So instead of the Tayloristic approach, you should look at, you know, what do they deliver? And what you see now, indeed, allies, is, you know, when you look at online labor platforms, for instance, is one setting up where remote work happens. There's this big question, should you use input measures or output measures? Because if you use output measures, you cannot do complex work. It all has to be piecemeal work, micro work, generalized skills. But if you use input measures like keystrokes or hours worked, you can have undefined work with an employee. And you just measure if they're working, they will get paid. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, those input measures with remote work. And we haven't really found what works best with these remote workers. And, you know, views on it might have changed a bit. Exploring, like, what work lends itself to being done remote. And is it really simple work? You know, making garments in the pre-industrial age, as you can see very clearly in, for instance, the Tenement Museum in New York, or high-skilled knowledge work nowadays, such as software engineering and data science.
Yeah, I think those are really good points, Greta, and something that so many people now are concerned with as well, because you see this proliferation of people concerned with, am I being productive enough? And finding all sorts of ways to measure their own productivity, reading up on how to become more productive. So this self-management issue, which they're pointing out here, was a deficiency at the time. I think that paradigm has absolutely dominated at least knowledge work and the sort of more high-skilled work that you mentioned. And almost to people's detriment, again, because the idea of self-management there is being interpreted as how do I optimize my output? And yet, actually, well, some of the issues that are being raised already in 1988 are this tendency to overwork. So perhaps we're optimizing for the wrong things there. So it's an ongoing struggle. And there's a proliferation of technologies, also apps and things that are being used to help people monitor their own performance to try and, you know, or even to stop themselves from using the internet at the wrong time, or, you know, how do you keep yourself off Facebook so that you stay concentrating? And people are installing these technologies more and more themselves. So I don't know, Demetrius, I think that the Taylorism principles have maybe become more individualized, that it's less the manager's role and more the individual's role, but they're still applying these scientific management principles to themselves, kind of have created an ideal out of them and try to optimize their own work practices in the way that Taylor probably would have been proud of. I'm not sure.
I mean, maybe. But I think that's partly where also the analogy with the cottage industry sort of starts falling apart, because I was reading up on exactly what that was, and it's not what we see now, or even what Forrester was sort of critiquing or envisioning. So the cottage industry was this craft mechanism for producing, yeah, sort of on large scale, but also not mass produced things. And it was largely something people did when they couldn't harvest crops in winter. So weaving baskets or just cutting things out of wood or whatever. You know, that's not the nature of work that is being talked about in the forest, and certainly not what we're talking about now.
Could we dive a little bit into some of the emotional issues that Forrester raises around guilt and isolation?
Yes, I want to talk about the honeymoon period.
Okay. So, Greta, yeah. Do you want to kick off?
Yeah, sounds good. Midway in the paper, Atkinson also reports a little bit of his autoethnography, because he worked from home for 7 years as a writer. He worked full-time and completely self-employed in Brighton. And in this period, he was heavily involved in politics. He also had two children in that period who were born, and he already had one, so that was a total of three. And he reports on his experiences, and he talks about this what he said apparently familiar cycle, where there was an initial honeymoon period, and that was 2 to 3 years actually, which was accompanied by feelings of elation, high productivity, and then a period followed of being less satisfactory. Feelings of lonely, isolation, and a growing desire to escape these four walls from the home. And in the end, he actually gave up full-time homeworking, and he picked up a three-day job. And what was it? A computer paper. I don't know what he meant with that, but to kind of help resolve the problem. And that was in 1986. And then he also mentions like his group of friends who kind of had similar experiences. And we kind of already summarized the outcomes of that. And it kind of draws attention, the psychological skills, capabilities that are required to be able to be a good and healthy home worker. And Forrester kind of concludes that, for most people, having the option to go to the office and being able to balance working at home and working at work is probably the most realistic of all of the possible futures.
I really enjoyed these stories from Atkinson's study as well. And I found it so interesting also hearing this idea of, he describes the guilt and feelings engendered by hearing the children crying or arguing and not being able to intervene, or hearing young children happily playing and not being able to join in. And this general issue of, you know, there's this other world going on that you can't engage with or that's intruding on your work life. And I also found it interesting, this comment about how do you explain to a two-year-old that daddy in the kitchen making a cup of coffee is thinking about his next paragraph and is not to be interrupted. And of course, there's a whole gendered nature here, which Forrester goes into a little bit, but it's generally seen as a you know, for that time, traditional household of the man working and the wife at home who's bothered by this man working from home, you know, wants her domain back, which is a bit old-fashioned, but was still quite amusing. But I also, I could relate to this because I grew up in a household where both parents worked from home. My mum's an artist and my dad runs the business. So I grew up in this household where mum and dad are in the workshop office working. And so to me, these boundaries become learned, you know, that there are these times of work and there are expressions that denote work. I sometimes now am reflecting on how much growing up with that as a normal feature now influences also my experience of remote work versus people who have grown up in a household where parents, either one or both, would leave the house and come back at night, which I can't actually imagine having them always gone in that way. So this is a it takes it all the way from experiences of work and organizing to also just experiences of life. Like, what are our rhythms and routines and expectations, and what are the impact of those, and what is considered normal or non-standard, and what are the implications of those judgments as well, because they do become judgments, what's usual or not. So I think there's a lot to unpack there, even though he goes over it quite briefly.
Yeah, what are the boundaries, effectively? How do you, you know, work late from home or things like that? Or how do you, you know, you have calls with different time zones and you do that from home, and, you know, if you're not living in a large house, and, you know, how do you coordinate that with your partner? And more importantly, how do you, as Greta pointed out, not overwork when you're at home? You know, I have... That's my experience anyway. You know, I'm home. I generally don't work exclusively from the office, but, you know, when I'm home now, having calls and conferences and recording lectures occasionally and so on and so forth, you know, when I'm done, that's no longer this kind of an obvious work thing that I'm doing. And then my partner wants to, you know, go for a walk or do something together, and, you know, I want that too, but sort of still supposed to be doing some more work things, or even thinking about it, but you're still physically and not in the workspace, and that, yeah, that's not super obvious what to do in that situation either, or how to establish healthy boundaries that work for everyone when you're still cohabiting a very, you know, relatively small space together.
And that also makes me think about, you know, we are all as academics in a profession that lends itself more or less to, you know, it's easy when you have a preference to work from home to do it. When you're teaching, of course, you go to the university, but I have lots of colleagues who prefer to do their writing and their, you know, their research and data analysis at home, because then they have kind of some downtime. But then I'm thinking, for instance, about my sister and a partner who are now working at home, and they're both in managerial roles, being in calls all the time. You know, they're even on separate floors because they get completely crazy of each other being constantly in these calls. And so we shouldn't forget the nature of the work that we're doing, and that it's really not for everyone. And especially, you know, when you're having lots of meetings, it's the experience I hear from people is that it's really, really draining to do that all remote using Zoom, especially when you're not used to it.
I think we all can. That's absolutely true. And what I think is happening there, and what I actually see Forrester doing a little bit as well, and perhaps where he misses a trick, is trying to translate what we know from office life so directly into the home world. So we would meet face to face for an hour in the office, therefore we must have an hour Zoom at home. Whereas there are other ways of collaborating, for example, in an asynchronous format or on a doc where we don't need to speak. But there's such a literal translation happening of what work is into the home space, and it doesn't really work. It's not compatible. And I think that that's also where Forrester maybe gets it a little wrong. He's also imagining that it has to be this direct translation of the equipment that you have in the office. It has to all be at home, and that's just ridiculous, and that's not going to work. But there are ways to make it work. And as he mentions, there are a lot of remote workers and people who work from home who figure it out, but they figure out their own ways. It's not the exact same experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I see these, some of the departments at universities still hold these weekly coffee meetings, but over Zoom. And some people seem to be happy with that. For me, it just bums me out. Like, I welcome the opportunity to not necessarily have to spend that time with my colleagues, and rather, you know, maybe take that hour off to have coffee with my partner or go for a walk or, you know, something. But as you said, it, translating what goes on in the office directly into your home, I mean, that's just, at best, unfeasible, and at worst, that's just dystopian. You can't just, you know, plug yourself in like in the Matrix and now you're at work and in your virtual office. Even though technology, you know, the technology parts of this paper didn't age well at all. We didn't talk about this, but there's not much to talk about. You know, online shopping is huge. Online banking, ubiquitous.
Yeah, he's saying, why would anyone, you know, ever not want to go to the bank?
It's such an enjoyable read also to read about all these technologies and use at the time and how they have all changed.
And I don't know if I get it right, but it really, I thought it's strange that there is no mention to the internet. Because because in the 80s, the universities already had. It's not the commercial internet that we see, that we had, but because if you put internet on the text is all wrong. Everything is getting more easier. So I really kept thinking, what kind of work that people are doing without the internet? Maybe because I cannot think without internet anymore. but
I was asking the other day my partner, like, do you remember when we were growing up how useless the internet was?
Yeah, true. And maybe that's something that is misleading from the statistics that. Here I criticize it because self-employment, it's not the same as working from home. And so we are talking maybe, that middle class idea that he puts, that's a lot of work, but how these people get connected with their work by this time? So I got thinking I really got curious about the infrastructure that he's talking about and criticizing. Because now this sounds much more easier because all the Zooms meeting and all the calls that we are making now are showing that maybe I don't have a large home in Bermuda and Vermont that like the author that he criticized because it's not but it's easier to make some parts of my work from home. So, I don't know about that. I think that one thing that I got thinking about the text and reflecting on my work is that doing network is something that's difficult from home. We can put many people in a Zoom meeting, but you cannot really have a conversation with them and everybody have to discuss once. Not at the same time. That's something that it's good to measure how your speech is affecting people. So this kind of thing that he puts that personal contact is something that is still important. It will be, I think, for a long time.
I wanted to go back to, you know, the part he wrote about, you know, home shopping. And where we kind of say how he was completely off there. And it kind of made me think, you know, what was the reason that we all decided to shop online? And when you think now, and you know, Forrester worked from home for 7 years, and he says that while home shopping can be useful, he says it is a lonely business, and most ordinary people positively welcome the opportunity to get out of the house and to go down to the shops. And I'm thinking about my life now in lockdown. You know, going to the shop is the highlight of my week. And I remember when I wrote my PhD thesis, the lady at the supermarket sometimes was the only person talking to me. And when this person was really grumpy, I was so grumpy as well. I'm like, you know, you're the only person I'm seeing today. Can't you be a little bit more polite? And then you think like, okay, I think this is probably, we can talk about this after the break, but you know, there are a lot of things that we have just let happen in how as a society we changed. And I feel that, you know, the lockdown really is a moment to stand still and think like, is this how we want things to be? And, you know, what I see is that, you know, the lockdown has meant a lot of more connectivity in my neighborhood. We have a neighborhood app group helping out each other. You know, you thank the person in the supermarket for their service, that they're still working and you can get your groceries, and being really thankful for those things. And those are some positive changes I see now. And, you know, then you're like, okay, if we all go back to the old, then that's gone as well. And do we want that? So I do think that Forrester is onto something here that might have been beyond this time and maybe even beyond our time.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. You may not know this, but we really love receiving feedback from our listeners. So if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some of the best people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Karamustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Peaks Kraft, Timothy Paul, Willy Lechton Wirta, and Gabriel Van Bunnen. And I apologize if I mispronounced your name. You are still the best and we love you so much. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website where a donations button will greet you. You can't miss it. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time for part 2 of the episode here on Talking About Organizations.